Welcome to another episode of Congo Kids Life Stories, where I share my experiences of growing up in the Congo in Central Africa. My hope is you find knowledge, entertainment, information, and insight of another culture and a new perspective of the Congolese people and Africa. Welcome back to Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. The series about the history of the establishment of the Evangelical Free Church mission work in the northwest corner of Congo in the Ubangi region. The Free Church started in 1884 with 22 churches of mainly Swedish immigrants to support home and foreign missions. One of the early mission efforts was to support missionaries in the Belgian Congo. I decided to do this series on the history of the Free Church mission work because my family was part of the effort for 25 years in the 1960s through 1990. Many of the events in this series involved me and my parents. I felt that sharing the journey from the beginning, as well as the stories of all those that passed away during the effort, was important. Many may know bits and pieces of this 100-year history, but to my knowledge, nobody has assembled the entire timeline of our mission work. Also, much new information and historical data is part of this series, and now it'll be preserved for future generations. This is episode 7 of 7, the final one. As a quick recap, the first episode told the story of the work of the Free Church Mission starting in the early 1920s, led by the vision of Titus Johnson. They established three mission stations by 1936. The second episode covered adding three more mission stations from 1936 to 1947. Episode 3 covered the period from 1948 to 1952, where yet more mission stations were established. Episode 4 included more stations being established and the beginning of transferring responsibility to the Congolese church. Congo's independence occurred in 1960, resulting in the evacuation of the missionaries. The fifth episode took us from 1963 to 1973 with a rebel invasion, the Lingala Bible being delivered, and two 50-year celebrations of the mission work. Then, episode 6 further explained the government's changes in the mission work, the Mbaka Bible being translated, and two evacuations due to political instability and a civil war. The previous episode noted four more missionaries passing away, including Dr. Titus Johnson, our mission founder. So far, in the prior six episodes, you've heard the stories of 19 adults or children that passed away, paying the price for the mission work with their lives. This final episode, number 7, will cover the period from 1998 to 2022, which marks the official 100-year anniversary of when the work started in the Ubangi region of Congo.
And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Romans 10:15.
I previously mentioned that with the 1997 civil war and overthrow of the government, the mission boards evacuated all the missionaries. Everyone was waiting for peace to be restored in Congo, or to determine if the work would continue, since we'd essentially turned over the work completely to the local church at that point. How would we relate to them moving forward was yet to be seen. The missionaries had already planned for departure in 1996, but had to evacuate any remaining personnel in the fall, as Laurent Kabila and his soldiers began marching from the eastern border through the country to eventually reach Kinshasa. President Mobutu had fled to Morocco as he knew his gig was up, and Laurent Kabila took over the presidency. Also, with his takeover from Mobutu, Kabila changed the name of the country from Zaire to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Many refer to it as DR Congo. During this time of civil war that went on for several years, the civilians around the country escaped into the forest for safety. This unfortunately led to many dying from poor water, lack of food and medical care, and disease. Between the rebel soldiers wreaking havoc and destruction on their march to the capital and the loss from living in the forest, they estimated 3 to 5 million people were killed or died in the late 1990s in Congo. Though this did make the news, most Western countries didn't pay much attention to it. Minimal effort by Europe and America and the United Nations resulted in the war and atrocities to continue for longer than it should have. After all, it was in Africa and in a little-known area that didn't impact the world economy in any significant way. The soldiers looted everything, including churches, houses, offices, vehicles, and equipment. So for the ordinary Congolese who had minimal possessions to begin with, returning from living in the jungle to their empty or destroyed house or hut in the village was emotionally devastating. Homes also fell into disrepair. Mud walls and thatched roofs need people living in them and cooking fires to keep termites away and to repair and sustain a home. The looting wasn't done just by the soldiers. Local people also participated. They were called anti-development agents. The mob mentality took over in many cases, further causing destruction. There were soldiers from Rwanda and Uganda that participated in the anarchy, and brutal soldiers from Angola and Chad supporting the Zaire government, but based in the Central African Republic, also did much of the killing and destruction on the road from Gemena to Zongo. Whole towns were burned and villagers killed. Someone reported that there was a 25-mile stretch where a traveler wouldn't see anyone. The few people left didn't know who was in a truck, so would hide when a vehicle passed through their village. The average citizen often wasn't sure which group was roaming the area, if they were part of the civil war and rebel group from Laurent Kabila or not. So that, too, added to the lack of stability and peace. Law and order wasn't fully restored, to put it lightly. The church tried to continue to function during this most difficult time. Since most vehicles were taken by the rebel soldiers, transportation was difficult. The shortwave radios were also taken, so communications was almost impossible. Yet, congregations continued in the jungles. People met in churches in the villages when it was safe. People's faith remained strong in spite of political, military, social, and economic chaos. Pastor Nubako Selenga was the president of the Congolese Free Church during part of this period. It was a most difficult time to oversee 600-plus churches as the war had pushed folks into the jungle and the soldiers had looted and pillaged the church facilities and equipment. Nubako shares.
Zambia ponaka moto na tango moko precis.
I have learned that God calls someone for a reason. God called me to lead the Congolese church during this time. I didn't have a clue how to tackle the job during this most difficult time. The office and homes were looted. Furniture, radios, and equipment were ransacked by the rebels. They took the trucks and damaged the hospital. Medicines and medical care was non-existent. I asked God to help me. Where do I start? People were meeting together in the jungle, but with no church buildings and communication, what to do? They had no hope during this time of war, and they were living in horrible conditions, like animals in the jungle, just trying to survive. In one case, a woman died, and there were no clothes for her to place her in her grave, so they dressed her in pants and a man's shirt. God told me to tour the entire region to connect with the people and bring encouragement to them. So I gathered a few of the church leaders, and we spent time in prayer for God's guidance. Then we invoked Nehemiah as our example of overcoming the circumstances. This is where the Israelites went to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, while their enemies tried to stop them, with one hand building the wall with bricks and stones, and the other hand was a sword to protect themselves. We secured a truck, quite possibly Roger Eel's Toyota Hilux, and a merchant gave us diesel fuel. We held big services all over, and the folks would come out of the jungle. Lots of singing and preaching to bring joy and hope to the congregants. We conducted training sessions for the local leaders to help them. The services were truly a blessing to everyone. We toured the entire region conducting these services, and the local church grew strong. We also held conferences for pastors and their wives. Furthermore, the congregations emulated the early church, where if there was a need, any need, someone stepped up and sold a chicken or goat or did whatever to help their brother or sister in Christ. Also, the Free Church in the U.S. helped tremendously during this time. They sent funds to help rebuild infrastructure. They prayed for us and encouraged us. My family never went hungry. People gave us food, chickens and goats, so we would stay strong and healthy during this time. But the one thing that was very clear through all of this is that it is God's church. It isn't man's church. God's power sustained all the Christians during this time. I'm reminded that during good times, we don't think much about God and His hand of provision. It is during difficult times that we see God's providence and provision in our life.
In September 1997, the Free Church and Covenant sent a group of missionaries back to evaluate the situation and see what could be done to support the Congolese and the church work. The situation was sketchy as the new government was still understaffed and the military hadn't fully gained control of the country and the Ubangi region. Jim Snyder, who had served in Congo in the 1980s and 1990s, was one of the delegates on this trip. They had three main goals. First, to determine the timing of any possible return of missionaries to Congo. Second, the return of missionaries to Tandala to focus primarily on the hospital work. And third, to evaluate the needs for rebuilding infrastructure and to prioritize those needs regarding funding and staffing. It was a short trip and had its harrowing moments where passports were seized, the plane impounded, and some of the group being under house arrest for a few days. But the trip was productive, and several mission stations were visited and assessed. Yet, all the delegates on this trip were blessed to be back in Congo and were welcomed and celebrated by the Congolese pastors and friends. The church in the U.S. was able to send supplies and equipment to help people with their basic needs as the war had devastated the economy and normalcy. Ultimately, due to the two wars that ran from 1996 to 2003, the Free Church and Covenant concluded that the prior mission model would need to be changed and that former missionary staffing would never return to pre-Civil War levels. The Free Church and Covenant, however, each approached this a bit differently. The Free Church would exist in the context of a partnership and a non-resident capacity, with the mission providing coaching, short-term teams, funding for medical work and newly created ministries, and support for the leadership. The Covenant felt they needed to provide support and mentorship as well, but chose to continue involvement and therefore left some staff on the field. This developed over time as the transition continued due to the political unrest. The Free Church assigned Ken and Judy Landrud to the seminary in Bangui and Thelma Landrud to the joint Free Church/Covenant office in Bangui. A few more were staffed at Gemina. The Covenant had Bob and Karen Andrews, Keith and Florence Gustafson, and Mark and Deanna Thornbloom serving. Other missionaries moved to Cameroon or Central African Republic or Kenya to serve in various capacities until the wars ended. In 2003, when the peace accords were signed, a few more Covenant missionaries returned to the Ubangi region. And in the years thereafter, the staff count for the Covenant fluctuated between 8 to 10 total. With the evacuation in 1996 and the uncertainty if the work would continue due to the Civil War, many missionaries found new ministries in other African countries like Central African Republic, Ivory Coast, or Tanzania. One couple, the Colbys, moved to Kenya to work in pastoral training after the evacuation. Dr. Bill Colby met his future wife, Norma, at the Urbana Missions Conference in 1957. Though God was calling Norma to missionary service throughout her growing up years, Bill didn't know yet that God had a special calling. At the conference, Billy Graham taught on Matthew 9:37. Both Bill and Norma stood with most of the attendees to say they would go wherever God wanted. They kept in touch and became a team, planning to go where God would lead. And they got married in 1960. Bill finished his degree, then medical school, residency, a two-year army stint serving in Vietnam, being honorably discharged with the rank of captain. Then they did all the missionary preparation. They went to Belgium to learn French and finally arrived at Tandala Hospital in 1971. They and their four daughters served for many years with Dr. Bill working in the medical field and Norma working with women's ministry. His desire to serve the medical needs of the Congolese was superseded by his desire to share the gospel. His medical training was just a way to interact with people and help them with their Christian walk. I knew the Colbys and went to school with their kids. One thing I remember about Dr. Bill and Norma was their love of singing. They often sang duets together. At the time of the Free Church disengagement in Congo in July 1996, their next assignment had them heading to Nairobi, Kenya, as the nucleus for special seminar teams for sub-Saharan Africa. While heading to church one day, tragedy struck. Norma Colby shares what happened.
So we went to our car and it was needing gas. And we said, oh no, we've got to get gas. So we stopped at a gas station, got gas, and didn't notice that we got into the wrong lane. So we had a head-on collision with a British golfer who was with his friend. They had two SUVs. And so Bill pulled over to the right to get out of the way, and he pulled over to the left and crash. So then we'd had contact with Steve Lyons, who knew the new history of Nairobi. He had mentioned before when we were on a trip together that Nairobi Hospital was the best one. So a truck stopped and put Bill in the back, and the SUV driver that we crashed into had me lie down and hit the back of his car. And we got to the hospital, and Bill was in getting his x-rays. And so I had a horrible whiplash. I said, I love you. He said, there's love, but it hurts to breathe. Anyway, so he had a detached left patella kneecap. He had broken femur. He had a broken arm in two places, a broken wrist on the other side, lacerations of the head, broken bones, rib cage. I don't know how many were broken when they tried to resuscitate him or how many had broken from the accident.
Merle and Claudia Weens were working with the Colbys in Nairobi and rushed to the hospital when they got the news. Merle tells about that day.
Well, with Claudia and I, along with Steve and Carol Lyons, who were visiting from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, as we arrived at the hospital around 10:30 in the morning, we initially saw Norma. She was on a bed in the hospital, not yet in a hospital room. She was bruised notably, but her injuries were minimal. She talked freely about the accident and assured us that she was going to be okay. She also told us that she and Bill shared a few precious, treasured moments together before Bill was taken off to the emergency room. Her concern, even at that time, was not for herself, but for Bill.
Merle was able to see Norma and also Dr. Bill before he went into surgery.
Yeah, when we arrived at Dr. Bill's hospital room, he had already been triaged with x-rays taken. Bill was immobilized due to various injuries, but was coherent and able to communicate clearly with us. In fact, he went over the x-rays of his injuries with us. He was very aware of the serious nature of these injuries. We remained at the hospital for nearly 3 hours, going back and forth between seeing Bill and Norma and having communication with the medical staff. Bill was scheduled for surgery that afternoon, so we planned to return in a few hours.
So after talking to the surgeons, Dr. Bill went into surgery. Norma shares about that time of waiting.
They said they'd tell me how things went, and nobody came. And then they brought me some food. First it was Chaplain who came. I told them my life story. Anyway, in the evening, then about 5:25, I said, Lord, have I been not praying enough? What's going on? And about 5 minutes later, the Lord spoke to me in my spirit and said, he's with me. And so when the surgeon wanted to talk to me and tell me what went on, I told him that we're Christians and Bill's with the Lord. He's had so much pain with his hips, arthritic hips, that I think the Lord just took him from it, and now he won't have that pain anymore. One of my major consolations was Isaiah 57:1, that says, the dead die young, and no one asks why. No one seems to understand that God is protecting them from the evil to come. For the godly who die will rest in peace. So that was a major comfort for me.
She explains the cause of death.
When he anesthetized him, his chest filled up with air, and an autopsy the next day. The story probably is that his trachea was blocked by a blood clot, and that's probably why he could talk. The driver of my car said, they're cutting him out of the car. He's hurt much worse than you are.
Merle shares his reaction to the news of Dr. Bill's passing.
The four of us, my wife Claudia plus Steve and Carol Lyons, arrived back at the hospital early in the evening, fully expecting to hear that Bill had come through the surgery well and would begin the recovery process. Instead, we met Norma, who shared with us that Bill had passed away during surgery. None of us were expecting to hear that message. I was personally shocked upon learning of Bill's death and wondered how, having had conversations with him hours earlier, that he was now gone. It was the beginning of processing Bill's passing. Earlier in the day, I had updated our pastor from Karura Community Chapel about the accident. Upon word of Bill's passing, he joined us at the hospital to bring pastoral support to Norma and all of us in those early moments of grief.
The group then went to see Norma.
She had been given the news probably, I'm thinking, about 30 to 40 minutes before we arrived back at the hospital. She had told nobody that knew her until we arrived. So I think part of even her processing her grief was telling us about Bill's passing and just sharing those moments together. They were sweet moments. I'm glad both Steve's wife, Carol, and my wife, Claudia, were there. I think that was very helpful as well.
So Dr. Bill Colby passed away at approximately 5:25 p.m. on July 19th, 1998, at the age of 59. They held a memorial service in Kenya. Merle shares his memories of that day.
Well, Norma was discharged from the hospital within a couple of days, and we worked with her to arrange a local memorial service. It included an open time of sharing about memories of Bill's life. I distinctly remember Norma wanted those in attendance to have dinner together with her at an Ethiopian restaurant where she and Bill last ate out a meal together, which was a very special event for Norma and all of us, for that matter. By now, Joanna, Bill and Norma's youngest of four daughters, had arrived from the U.S. to be with Norma. Her presence at the memorial service and just spending time with Norma, supporting her, was a blessing to Norma, certainly, and to all of us as well.
There needed to be a decision as to where he should be laid to rest. Bill and Norma's daughters felt that had he died in Congo, he should be buried there. However, the family did not have a deep connection in Kenya. One of the Colby daughters said,
"Congo was home."
So the family really wanted to return the body to the United States for burial. This was not a simple affair, as Merle explains.
Many of the details of sending Bill's body back to the States for internment elude me now 28 years later. However, I do remember it was an arduous process with much paperwork from multiple sources, complicated by the accident. This is where both the memorial home and the U.S. Embassy stepped in to support and at times lead the process.
Fortunately, the mission had insurance for this type of situation. So Dr. Bill's body was flown back to Illinois. A celebration of life service was held with family and friends. And he was buried next to all the Colbys in the community cemetery near Atkinson, Illinois. So the 20th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Dr. Bill Colby.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
The headstone has Bill's name and birth date, October 30th, 1938. The headstone also has Norma's name, waiting for her date of departure. Also inscribed is the verse,
"Blessed are the feet of those who bring good news." Romans 10:15.
Sound familiar? After Bill's passing, Norma was flipping through Bill's Bible and came to 2 Timothy 4:6, which states,
"For I am already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time for my departure is near."
In the margin was written the word departure. Norma believes that Bill knew his time was near. Norma did later return to Tandala, Congo, where they'd served for so many years to visit, and fellow medical workers conveyed their sorrow at the loss.
when I went back in 2001, I think it was, with Thelma, I got to say thank you and how much we loved them, and I'd continue praying for them. And Bama came over and cried on my shoulder, and people said, oh, we're just so sad to hear that this happened.
Another person commented.
And she said, God knew that he was going to take him home, but he waited till he got back to Africa because he loved the Africans so much.
Merle and Claudia Weens had worked with the Colbys in Congo and then were with them in Kenya. I asked Merle to share a special memory of Bill.
Bill was dedicated. He was humble. He was a gentle servant of the Lord. And he and Norma spent their last few years in Africa teaching pastors and wives as well as lay couples. And one thing that I specifically remember is they loved to teach together on marriage, and they viewed this as a significant area of need in the African context. And it truly was. Bill and Norma's life was a demonstration of what a godly marriage looked like, and they freely shared that with others, and I would include myself in that. So that would be a tribute that I think of when I think of Bill and Norma now, 28 years later, after Bill's passing.
Norma stayed with the mission and served the seminary families with training, teaching, discipleship, and support in the Central African Republic until her retirement. To conclude this tribute of Dr. Bill's passing and Norma's continued faithfulness to the mission work afterwards, here's a short sample of their love of singing.
The joy of the Lord is my strength. 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 Soconalingie singona sanzola. Soconalingie singona sanzola. Socorro lingi e sengona sanzola, e sengona Yahweh is alingu yanangai, 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 e sengona Yahweh is alingu yanangai.
As a brief sidebar, Dr. Bill Colby was the only person returned to the United States for burial. Conversely, only one person has ever been returned to Congo for burial, and that was Bob Thornbloom. After his death in 2020, the Congolese Covenant Church president and church leadership asked that his body be returned for burial at Karawa. In a traditional Congolese ceremony, Bob was buried 60 feet from where he had been born in 1938, and had spent his childhood and lived serving amongst the people he loved. His son Mark and grandson Ben were able to be in attendance at his Congolese service. As mentioned previously, the Free Church had accelerated their transition plan after the 1991 evacuation, and then again after the 1997 Civil War. They no longer had resident missionaries in Congo. They did, however, maintain a relationship with the CECU, the local Congolese Free Church. The Covenant Church in the U.S. also recognized that it was time to pull back and take a less direct role with the Congolese Church. The Covenant did have a handful of missionaries return to Congo after the war in the late 1990s. Craig Wickstrom, who grew up in Congo, is now in the role of providing support and guidance to the Covenant Congo Church now in 2026.
I call myself liaison. So President Dwali of the CUM asked me to represent the CUM here in the U.S. And when I'm there, I represent the Covenant to the people in Congo. I don't have decision-making power as far as the Covenant goes. But my presence is a big help. And when I'm in Congo, I spend a fair amount of time often just chatting with President Dwali and other leadership. I've helped out with his trips here to the U.S. I feel like the most important ministry that I have is my presence. It's an encouragement to people. It points to the fact that, yes, there is a continuing relationship between the CUM and the Covenant.
Craig provided the following statistics for the Covenant Congo Church as of 2025. There are more than 1,900 church congregations with an estimated 400,000 members. There are nearly 1,700 pastors and nearly 19,000 deacons that serve the church. They also have over 50,000 choir members. The Congolese really love to sing. Education has always been a priority and passion, and the Congolese are eager to learn. The CEUM boasts being part of 600 schools from grades 1 through 12. There is one university and five seminaries. Five hospitals and 120 health clinics are supported by the church and its staff and laymen. Numerous other ministries abound, including agriculture, refugee care, and ministries serving men, women, and youth. There are only a few missionaries from the U.S. on the field, as the church is essentially self-sufficient and autonomous. This is reflected by the over 1,900 trained evangelists that are in the communities. These folks are sent and supported by their congregations. The Covenant Church in the States continues its support role to the CEUM, providing help, guidance, and encouragement as the Congolese church continues its journey of growth. Jim Snyder has a comparable role with the Congo Free Church. He served in Congo from the 1980s until 1996. He then became the Congo liaison for the U.S.-based Free Church and offers encouragement, support, and guidance. He's been in this role for over 25 years.
Yeah, I have been the advisor to the president since 2000. And so I am now on my fourth president. I'm also the international leader for Reach Global in Africa and the Congo country leader. So give oversight to all of our ministry in Congo relationship with the Seku Church.
The U.S. mission visited the Congo Church in the year 2000 to share how the mission's relationship would be changing going forward.
That was kind of the beginning, and then shortly thereafter, I traveled to Congo and talked to Pastor Salenga. Thelma Landrieu and I went there, and we just let them know that we were going to be changing our posture as a mission to Seku, and wanted him to realize that we were now standing next to them as legitimate partners rather than overseers of ministry, that we wanted to do whatever we could to support them in their roles and what God had called them to do. And that was the beginning of Salenga's presidency.
He visits Congo 3 to 4 times per year. Though villages don't have internet or electricity, most cities in Congo now have internet access, which makes connectivity much easier. The availability of Starlink has been a game changer. So with video chat technology and email, he is able to be in contact with the Congo church leaders. Jim was able to participate in the 100-year celebration of our mission in November 2022 that was held in Gemena. The church focused on the mission work and the positive influence of the missionaries, going back to Dr. Titus Johnson, and the spiritual impact that the gospel has had on the people in Congo. It was a big deal, as the celebration started the year before and was celebrated quarterly in various regions and culminated with a big 4-hour celebration at Gemena.
Throughout the year, there were celebrations that took place in different regions. They kind of grouped them up into 4 different groups, and they celebrated in each of those, and they had a big Sunday. And so first quarter, there were 10 regions that gathered together, 8 regions. And then the second quarter, same thing, third and fourth. And then it culminized then with the 100th anniversary celebration in Gemena. They held the event outside. It was between the mission station in Gemena and Kimia. So there's a big open space there that they filled with platform and banners and seats and choirs. And it was a huge thing. I think it went for almost 4 hours. And delightful time. A number of speakers, And the time actually went quite quickly, despite the fact that it was very hot. It was a delightful, delightful time.
I asked Jim about his emotions during the festivities. I wonder if he felt like a proud father shaking his child's hand as he or she graduates from college and is heading off on their own to live their life. Or did he feel like a parent that hugs his daughter or son at their wedding, proud of their accomplishments, and yet is a bit hesitant to let them go and launch out on their own?
The detail to which the celebration was done was amazing. Throughout, even on the celebration that took place a year before the actual 100th anniversary, obviously everything was focused on Titus, you know, and the reality that not only he, but so many others had come, had given so much, had sacrificed so much, and invested in the development of what was over 100 years. That reality, the president of the ECC was there at that event a year before the anniversary, and he very clearly stated that there was only one other denomination in Congo that had lasted 100 years, that had been birthed out of a missionary effort, that it is a very rare thing in Congo for both the existence of the church after 100 years, but the existence of a relationship with those who had birthed them that was healthy and moving forward and enabling and not lording over in some ways, but celebrating along with them all of the things that had happened. And granted, you know, that it's life. Not everything is beautiful or perfect. It's in some ways like a family. It's the reality of the dirty and living through it. That's what celebration is all about. It's not that everything was glorious. It's that it's still good, alive, and God is being honored through it. So that was kind of my thinking and my attitude throughout the entire year. It was their attitude of seikyu, and they built on that. You know, recognizing the huge sacrifices that families had made of those who had died, of the years that were very, very difficult around the 60s, the contributions that had been made by families in the and missionaries in the investment of those who are currently leading. And we look at like the Selengas and the Alenge and a lot of the people that I've worked very closely with over the last 25 years that have been the fruit of the labors of so many of our missionaries who were there in the 60s and 70s. So all of that was just over the top, actually recognized. There were awards given to missionaries who had made major contributions, and it was not only humbling, it was a little bit beyond that.
All former missionaries were sent a thank you note and a framed certificate of recognition for serving with the Free Church Mission in Congo. I got one, as I was a short-termer in 1982 to 1983. All the missionaries that served in the prior 100 years were celebrated at a special event held at Pelendo's house. This event made an impact on Jim. So if you were ever in Congo as part of the mission effort, this next section is just for you.
Every one of us looks back and wants something, an evidence that our contributions were meaningful and that the sacrifices made were worth it. And sometimes we don't get that. You know, scripture is full of examples of people that gave and gave and that was it. But one of the exciting things that we did that was very tastefully done was a celebration that was done thinking back on Pelendo by his family. They invited all of those who attended the 100th. And there were about a dozen of us that went to Pelendo's house, their kid's house, just outside of Gemena. And it was a big celebration of the 100th and thinking back on the life of Pelendo. And One of the things that makes that so significant, not just the stories and not just the long time influence of Pallendo, but the reality that he was one of the first evidences of God having used a mission to birth something that was beyond us, that God was at work in ways that were extra special as a result of the investments of people all the way back to Titus through everyone who had an impact on the life of Pallendo. And it was like something very tangible that expressed that, look what God has done as a result of all this. And it was probably one of the first, and because of that, I look back and I think of all of the second, third, fourth, fifth of the investments made and how meaningful that has been, not only to those who were able to make those investments, but to the church in Congo, as they look back and see, yes, God was at work. And as a result of the investments of both missionaries, as well as those who were involved in leading the church there in Congo. So that was a very special time to be able to celebrate that. And it was very tastefully, very well done. And we all enjoyed being able to do that together with them.
So, Jim, were there any special moments from individuals sharing appreciation or giving their thanks for your work in Congo as a missionary and now as an advisor to the Congolese church?
Yeah, this is more on a personal note. Back when Ruth and I were at Tandala, we obviously there is a lot of activity there that comes out of the hospital. And while we were there, one of the pastors, Seiki Pastor, had his wife at the hospital. She was giving birth to a child, and she died during delivery, and there was no one to care for the baby. So, you know, the appeal went out to the mission, and Ruth took the baby for the first, I don't know, couple of weeks or something like that. Somebody else took her for a couple of weeks, and in the meantime, the pastor figured out what he was going to do, and he ended up taking the child with him back to the village, and he came up to me at the 100th and said thank you, and then introduced his daughter to me. And that was uber cool to be able to see. You know, it was just one of those 100 million things that missionaries do on the side. You know, it's not what God necessarily called us to do, but it was who God had called us to be. And so it was a lot of fun being able to celebrate that moment.
So looking back at the 100 years of our missions effort, it is truly an amazing journey. Dr. Titus's first encounter at Karawa in 1922 was with Niengo, an outlaw and cannibal. And recall his first church service resulted in numerous wounded people as two villages fought. It's truly amazing how far things have come since then. In 2023, the Congo Free Church reports the following statistics. 1,400 church parishes, 1,084 pastors. There were 3,700 baptized in 2022 alone. They show 2,130,000 attendees in their churches, counting men, women, and children. There are 579 schools the church is involved in, with 377,000 students total. School teachers number over 11,000. The church is also involved in almost 100 dispensaries, health centers, hospitals, and other medical efforts. 13 doctors and almost 200 nurses and 424 administrators and other workers support the medical efforts. And there are other ministries that the CECU is involved in, like participating with World Vision, working with widows and orphans at the Elikia Center, providing hope and care for children with disabilities at the Promise Home, and Global Fingerprints, the Free Church Child Sponsorship Program. Wow, this is quite amazing. What a testament to the efforts of all the missionaries and Congolese Christians over the years and God's blessing on the work. But the reports and statistics I just shared of the ongoing work of both the Free Church and Covenant Congolese churches relating to schools, hospitals, ministries, and so on is a legacy, no doubt. And it is due in large part to the missionary efforts of the last 100 years. And the series up to this point has been from the missionary's perspective relating to the work and journey of the mission and church in Congo. Information from books, articles, reports, and interviews have laid out the journey, all from the sending church's viewpoint. And no doubt my own bias has come through to a degree as to how we, the mission, reported how the mission's efforts and work played out over the decades. But what about the Congolese point of view? How did the daughter church look at our efforts for all these years? Especially now, since they've been virtually on their own since the late 1990s. I've asked Nubako Selenga to provide his perspective. His father was a pastor in the 1970s in the Tandala area, as well as the vice president of the CECU. He went to Institute Kimya in Gemena and was taught by my dad and was on my dad's evangelism team for 4 years. He then went to seminary and pastored a church for a time. Then, about the time of the Civil War in the late 1990s, he was elected to be the president of the Congo Free Church, the CECU. You already heard a bit about that earlier in this episode. Then, in 2009, he and his wife were asked to join the Free Church mission staff. They became the first African missionaries to serve with the Free Church mission. The division they work with is called Reach Global, and he became the director of Reach Africa, involved in church planting and pastoral training in 20 countries on the continent of Africa. Thousands of churches were planted between 2009 and 2015. Following this, he became the city team leader for Reach Global in Kinshasa. Based in Kinshasa, the capital, he and his wife can provide a unique viewpoint as they were the recipients of the mission's efforts beginning in the 1970s. And now they have grown to being on the other side, ergo, being a missionary to their own people. I can't think of a better person to share on this topic. As mentioned, the Congo Free Church, the CECU, put on a 100-year celebration in 2022. So I asked Nubako a few questions. Why did the CECU feel it important to do so, even though the missionaries had left permanently in 1997?
We felt it important to celebrate this milestone. We did it for three reasons. First, to remember. We recognize that God had worked through the missionaries and our pastors and laymen and women over an entire century, looking at the past to see who got us to this point. Second, to celebrate. We know it was through God's grace we are where we are as a church body. We celebrate the pioneers of our church looking back 10 decades. In spite of the death of missionaries and church leaders alike, political and economic turmoil, and the horrible wars, we celebrate those that went before us, and the church still stands. And third, to make a starting point for the next 100 years, we reflected on the past and also looked to the future and the vision for us to pursue. That is why we held the 100-year anniversary celebration.
He offers the following as a prayer of thanks to God for the missionaries' lives that invested in the Congolese church efforts.
I want to thank all those that came to Congo from the bottom of my heart. Thank you so much. You came to share the good news and to work to build the church. I am a fruit of that effort. So many found salvation from your efforts. I thank you for bringing your family and children to rough living conditions, giving up your life of money and a more comfortable life in the United States. And we know that you had to send your children away to school at Karawa, and so could not have a normal family life. This brings me sorrow to see this family sacrifice in coming here. And you lived among us. Know that you brought life and light to us in Congo. Salvation came to us because of you.
He recognizes the impact on the lives of those that had to leave due to medical and health issues, and also to those that died on the field.
I want to speak to those that lost spouses or children or had medical issues while in Congo. The Bible says that God will reward you for your work and sacrifice. Here on earth, you won't see it, but know that the Congolese see clearly the testament of your labors, and we pray that God will reward you for the sacrifices you made. You should be proud of your work. God will bless you for it.
So with the base the Congolese church has, here is their commitment to pressing forward.
Like an old, well-used woven mat that is on our bed, we always measure that and reference it when making a new mat to replace it. One always starts with the old to make the new. We recognize the foundation our church has that the missionaries helped establish. We plan to grow and build it. Similarly, we will do so through schools and training to raise up leaders and disciples. There used to be only missionary doctors and nurses. Now we have hospitals staffed by qualified Congolese nurses and doctors. We are growing workers and laymen and leaders to spread the gospel. We are taking what the missionaries left with us as a base and building on that for the future to even be bigger and more effective than what was left for us. That is our goal.
The Congolese church recognizes how far things have come since Dr. Titus arrived at Karawa in 1922. The capacity of the church in Africa to lead has been influenced significantly by the West, but there are some denominations that have struggled while others flourish. All have been influenced by political leaders, the economy, and by changes in culture and society. But why is the CECU where it is today?
The Congolese church is living and thriving because we are standing firm on the Bible. Other church denominations are drifting away from the faith. Yet in spite of politics, war, the economy, and the push and pulls of society, we always rely on the Word of God. We always go back to that. We rely on Scripture to live the Christian life. The CECU isn't perfect, has its foibles, but our strength is keeping Scripture a priority to retain our Christian walk. The missionaries trained our elders and forefathers very well in the Scriptures. These people were firm in their faith. They didn't waver, no matter what issues they had to work through. So we will train our new leaders and lay people from this foundation. That's the key to CECU's success, endurance, and growth.
I asked him what he would like to say to the missionaries in terms of their work, sacrifice, and efforts to help establish the church in Congo.
I want to express my profound gratitude to all former missionaries who came in Congo to evangelize the Ubangi and for their sacrifice. And it makes many things, good things in the USA to come here with the gospel. I'm so thankful on behalf of my brother and sister in Congo for the work they've done in Congo, in Ubangi. May God bless them and pay them for everything they did in Congo. I know that word can express our heart to them, but we are thankful for their sacrifice. May God bless them. Thank you.
I should mention that Nubako and his wife Claudine have many wonderful ministries, including over 300 Tabitha centers, which takes in street girls and teaches them a skill to get out of that life. I urge you to check out this incredible ministry. Search for Tabitha Center, T-A-B-I-T-H-A, Center, on Facebook or on the internet. They started a similar program for boys to teach them a trade so they can get out of the street and gang lifestyles. They currently have 5 ministries impacting hundreds of thousands of people every year, and these ministries continue to grow. So the partnership between the Free Church Reach Global and the Congo churches continues to this day. Empowering the local church has led to more ministry being done and more lives being changed than ever before. So how does Jim see things in the future between the U.S. Free Church and the Congolese Free Church?
We're thinking about this. Obviously, we're involved in some strategic planning now that we hope will foster not only development of SACU and leaders and the future, thinking about the future, but will also give us, I think, more clarity into how our ministries will function in the days ahead. We're backing out of every area of leadership and coming along as coaches and mentors in what we do. And so in a lot of ways, some of that can be done by afar. We're doing a lot more over video conferencing than we've ever done. But I anticipate for quite some time that there will be relationship that continues, especially in those areas where there is need in the context of leadership for anything from a reprieve from the weight of leadership and hosting people here in the United States for a period of time, connections with churches here in the States. We still have and will continue to have for some time a consortium of churches that are engaged in ministry in Congo.
The blessings of God through the Free Church and Covenant missionaries produced much fruit, as you just heard. And you also heard directly from a Congolese who benefited from the missionary effort and now in turn is a missionary to his people and the continent of Africa. This brings credence to everyone that served in missions in Congo over the years. You've now heard the story from beginning to end of the first 100 years. It's been fraught with trials, victories, defeats, sickness, death, unity, disunity, multiple evacuations, governmental interference, and internal disputes. The journey has been far from perfect and experienced its share of ups and downs. So did the missionaries achieve their ultimate goal to establish a church in their area of Congo? I would say a solid yes. The statistics of ongoing ministries shared by Craig and Jim support that. And the report from Pastor Selenga about the vision for the future reinforces that. The journey wasn't pretty and not how one would have wanted the ideal script to be written. But we don't live in a perfect world. We live in a fallen and sinful world, and the Belgian Congo in the 1920s and 1930s was a difficult place to start a mission work. Thus, how God moved the mission effort to result in an autonomous and mature, self-sufficient church will have many bumps in the road. Nor can we expect a fairy tale journey and ending and expect the Congo church to continue without any problems or challenges. But the missionaries can be assured that they all did their best and gave the Congolese church the training and tools to succeed as they lead their next generation of people to spiritual maturity. The story of the original 100 years has been told. But this isn't the end of the story. The Congolese church is moving forward into the next 100 years of growth and ministry to Congo and now all of Africa. The second century story is just starting, and it will be exciting to see how it progresses in the years ahead. This series was started by my desire to dig in and find the stories of all those that died on the mission field. But here's the story of what sparked it. The idea became clear to me a few years ago, but had been in my mind for 55 years, if you can believe it. In 1971, I had a BB gun at the mission station Kala and would try to shoot bats that were hidden on the trunk of a certain palm tree under the dead fronds. Several feet away was a cement grave, that of Stanley David Tweed, a boy that died in 1931 at the age of 3. It was a simple grave with his name, birth date, date of death, and a simple inscription.
Safe in the arms of Jesus.
As a young boy of 9, I would often wonder about Stanley. What did he look like? What did he die from? What was his life like 40 years prior in 1931? What did the mission station look like in 1931 when he died? All sorts of questions flooded my mind as a 9-year-old when I hung around his grave trying to shoot at bats in that palm tree. This was the same palm tree that was mentioned in my research that was near where his body was laid to rest. It was only about 6 feet tall when he was buried, as per the photo I saw. And in 2024, someone sent me an article, and in that was a photo of the Tweed family. And there was Stanley sitting on his mom's lap. Wow, after 54 years, I saw what this little boy looked like. All my wonderings and imagination from 1971 were finally realized as I stared at his photo. I dare say it was a spiritual moment. And that is when I committed to telling his story so it wouldn't be lost in a brief article from 1931. And from that, I committed to research and tell the stories of all the folks that died on the mission field. And then I tacked on telling the history of our mission work starting in 1920 with the vision of Dr. Titus Johnson. Then I added a mission station spotlight to tell the backstory of each station and have someone that lived there give a personal dimension. Indeed, I bit off a lot more than I thought 16 months ago. So here we are at the end of this series, all triggered because in 1971, I wondered about the backstory of a 3-year-old boy buried in a grave near a palm tree at the mission station called Kala in Congo, Africa. It is also important to recognize the sacrifices made by all the Congo missionaries, especially in the first 30 to 40 years. Sacrifices in terms of health, living conditions, travel, poor communications, struggles with the climate, sickness, and lack of medicines such as antibiotics that we now take for granted. How many people that got sick could have been healed much more quickly with modern medicines and equipment? How many that got sick or injured would have not resulted in becoming deathly ill due to lack of a simple malaria cure or antibiotic for an infection? Or with better communications or travel time? How many died because of the lack of medical equipment or the timely arrival of a doctor? There were so many adults that died because of this, and many children died from illnesses that are now preventable. And this doesn't mention how many people returned home to the States permanently due to health issues sustained on the field, never to return to Congo. Please know that the focus of this series is in no way minimizing all those people that served faithfully over the years for the furtherance of this work. Some served just for a few years. Others spent their entire careers in mission work, working tirelessly with little or no fanfare or recognition. There are hundreds of people between the Free Church and Covenant missions that served faithfully in numerous capacities from the 1920s until 1997 when the Civil War broke out. Teachers, mechanics, nurses, doctors, pastors, bookkeepers, gophers, women's ministry workers, builders, pilots, and many others. So while this series didn't focus on these career and short-term missionaries per se, it bears mentioning that they too deserve thanks and recognition for their service in following God's call to missions. They sacrificed considerably and continued on with the work of the mission in spite of the challenges of living in Congo. I should also mention those families that did serve but had to leave the field because of medical issues or illness due to the harsh environment. They too sacrificed to go to Congo, only to return home for medical reasons, forever changing their life trajectory. The functioning Free Church and Covenant churches in Congo are the fruit of their labors. There are a total of 20 adults and children that are mentioned in the series who passed away in the effort to open and serve the mission work in the Ubangi area of Congo. Many are merely a footnote in history or are mentioned in a one-page obituary in a newspaper from their hometown or the church's magazine from 80 or 90 years ago. And most are not even known by people outside the Congo missionary community or their immediate families. Many died generations ago and are forgotten by most everyone. Or their graves are halfway around the world in Africa, covered in sword grass, crumbled, and forgotten. And many of their families and descendants are in America and will never even see the grave to pay their respects and honor their lives. One saint is at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, about 800 miles east of Brazil, sunk by a German submarine. And our founder, Dr. Titus Johnson, is buried in Sweden. Dr. Bill Colby is the only person whose body was returned to the United States. So besides wanting to give an oral history of our mission work in Congo, I tried to bring honor and tribute to each of the deceased people that are shared about in this series. This is important history to preserve and a way to pay tribute to those that gave their lives. I don't want them to be forgotten or to be hidden in an online library archive that will only be discovered if someone is looking for them. Rather, I tried to bring their stories to life, to bring personality and humanity to these forgotten people. These once unknown people to you are now known, and their stories resonate their humanity and sacrifice. They were real people. They meant something to the Congolese and their families in Congo and in the States. These were all pioneers who sacrificed for God's kingdom with their lives or the lives of their children. They are all saints in my eyes. Let me remind you of the ultimate sacrifice given by the following people.
Bertha Peterson, fiancée to Titus Johnson, died of dysentery, May 15, 1921. Daniel Lloyd Johnson died of dysentery. He was 3 months old, June 8, 1926. Stanley David Tweed died of dysentery. He was 3.5 years old, May 19, 1931. Reinhold Anderson died of blood poisoning, September 5th, 1933. Grace Joan Skoglund died of malaria. She was 18 months old, June 16th, 1939. Arthur Skoglund died of an unknown illness, May 3rd, 1939. Beverly Thornbloom died of malaria. She was 5 years old, April 7th, 1942. Marion Nelson died when her ship was torpedoed by a German submarine, December 2nd, 1942. Ruth Johansson Robinson died from complications from delivery 3 days after childbirth, March 25th, 1946. Timothy Lambie Norton died of lung and heart issues. He was 1.5 days old, August 29, 1949. Evelyn Norrin died of a lightning strike, May 26, 1952. Clyde Carlson died of a heart ailment, July 26, 1957. Timothy Arden Almquist died at birth, May 5th, 1958. Baby boy Bergren, stillborn at birth, April 22nd, 1961. Dr. Paul Carlson died by a rebel's bullet while escaping captivity, November 24th, 1964. Clarice Hogberg died of liver failure, April 27, 1973. Dr. Titus Johnson died of a heart attack, January 16, 1974. Elizabeth Carlson died at birth, November 13, 1989. Vinette Thorsell died of complications from surgery for intestinal blockage, November 14, 1990. Dr. Bill Colby died from injuries sustained in a car accident, July 19, 1998.
I was able to connect with numerous people throughout the United States and Canada to hear their stories on the phone or a video call and add a wonderful dimension to this series. Tracking them down was fun and fulfilling and gave the listener a more personalized version of the stories and facts. I talked with people I'd not connected with in 40 or 45 years. Others I've never met in person, and yet they were willing to accept our mutual connection to Congo and participate in this series. For one person from the 1940s, I called in a favor with a private investigator friend to track him down. There are so many books and articles and materials that I was able to read and research in preparation of this series. I read thousands of pages from books and articles. I must commend several of the early missionaries to the field that kept detailed logs, documented their lives, or wrote books upon retiring. These documents painted an excellent picture of what it was like in those early years and preserved this most important history. To recognize the materials from whence considerable information was pulled to create this series, allow me to list them to give proper credit. The Evangelical Beacon, which was the Free Church monthly magazine. The Covenant Companion, which was the Covenant's monthly magazine. The Chicago Bladet magazine. The book Mount to the Sky Like Eagles by Bernard and Marjorie Palmer. The book Bread Upon the Waters by Paul and Elna Rosell. The book about the life of Titus Johnson, titled Deep Tracks in Africa, by Sigurd F. Westberg and Francis J. Mason. A report titled 25 Years in the Ubangi by Will Norton. A report titled Behind These 50 Years in the Ubangi, 1922 to 1972, by Richard Anderson. And a master's thesis by Nils Olberg called The History of the Zaire Mission, 1922 to 1975. Colleen is in Africa by Colleen Norton, and the book by Elizabeth Anderson titled Liz Remembers Too. Arden Almquist wrote The Covenant Mission in Congo, and the book When Africa Beckoned by Harvey and Ruth Widman were additional resources. There were detailed logbooks and other articles highlighting events in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s prepared by various people. Decades-old mission committee meeting minutes were reviewed. I read numerous obituaries from a plethora of newspapers throughout the United States. I received considerable archive information to review from Dr. Tom Cairns and Dr. Tim Wester, which was very helpful. And I peppered them throughout the past year with questions, clarifications, requests for photos, and other information. Yet they always responded timely, ready to help me in getting the information I needed. And Andy Myers, archivist of the Covenant Mission, dug through old boxes and files and scanned considerable key information to me to help me tell the Clyde Carlson and Clarice Hogberg stories accurately. Thanks to all that wrote this history to keep it alive in print and to those now that are preserving it for future generations. Special thanks to Norma Colby for sharing about her husband Bill's passing in this episode, and to Merle Weens for sharing about Dr. Bill as well. Thanks to Craig Wickstrom for his comments on the Covenant's work with the Congolese Covenant Church now and in the future, and Jim Snyder for his summary and comments about the 100-year celebration that was held in 2022 and on partnering with the Congolese now and in the years ahead. And having Pastor Nubako Selenga share about the Congolese perspective of the mission work really rounded out this final episode. I also extend thanks to the 36 people that interviewed for this series. Many folks I knew from growing up, and many I've never met in person and didn't even know them before this series connected us with a shared story about a loved one or a place in Congo. Bringing your firsthand knowledge of the people that died on the field or a mission station to add authenticity is appreciated and help make this series as complete and rich as possible. And thanks to the numerous folks that did voiceovers to help give these stories more realism. Rick Saleen was the voice of Titus Johnson for the first six episodes and a portion of this episode. Rick and Mike Davis really did a lot of the heavy lifting in this series. You guys are amazing. Also, Tim Snow, Jim Barber, Jeff Peterson, Chris Carpenen, Anthony, Juliana, and Ellie Shea, Kim Hart, David Olberg, and a few others filled in throughout this series. Bob Thiergartner recited the intro verse, Romans 10:15, for each episode, and Psalms 116:15 after someone had died. A few of you could be professional voiceover actors, and I mean that. Thanks to all for your voiceover efforts. You were all fantastic. You all gave graciously of your time and talent to this series. But the biggest thank you goes to my wife, Dawn, for numerous voiceovers and redoing some of them multiple times to get them just right. Yes, I'm a tough director trying to get the sound and tone perfect, but also for her patience and support these past 16 months as I have spent hundreds of hours holed up in my den working on this massive project. You're the best, honey. I also had Dr. Tim Wester, Doug Thorpe, Jim Snyder, Dr. Nick Sofa, and Craig Wickstrom read my script to help ensure accuracy to the facts and storyline. Thank you for your editing and contributions as I fine-tune the storyline for accuracy in final presentation. So I hope you enjoyed and learned from this series about the history of the Evangelical Free Church work in Congo and that of the Evangelical Covenant Church, our sister organization that we worked alongside in the Ubangi area. There were so many other events that were part of our mission work and the journey of our church that I didn't have time to elaborate on. This series was long enough, and I tried my best to hit the high points and keep the storytelling relevant for the listener. But if you choose to dig down more, I urge you to track down the books and resources I referenced earlier. This series has been an amazing journey, spanning over 100 years, harking back to that young Swedish boy, Titus Johnson, who felt called to Africa by reading Uncle Tom's Cabin. His faithfulness, vision, and hard work sparked the mission effort. He was joined by so many others over the years, including my family, who brought Christ and a strong church work in the Ubangi region of Congo to fruition. You heard the many trials encountered along this journey. You also heard the many triumphs achieved as well. Pastor Chuck Swindoll once said,
"The heart of this story is the lingering lessons."
For me, there are many lessons. The faith, sacrifices, and perseverance of following God's call to Africa through all the obstacles by all the missionaries sticks with me. The early pioneers are to be honored as they had it so hard compared to when my family went out in 1965. Though living in Congo was challenging, it was much easier than the burden and difficulties the first wave of missionaries experienced getting things started in the 1920s through 1950s. Another thing for me is their total faith to pursue the mission work and see the church flourish when they were starting from scratch. Imagine sitting for over a year, like Titus Johnson, on a small 1-acre plot of land waiting for the Belgian government to authorize their mission work to get started. Or the frequency of serious illness and death the pioneering missionaries endured. And yet, they continued on in spite of those setbacks. These are but a few key points that will stick with me forever after preparing this series. So what are your takeaways from this amazing 100-year journey? What will stay with you? What will resonate with you? Was it a particular pioneer's faith and tenacity that you remember? Was it the story of one of the saints that died? What is the heart of this story for you? I'd love to know. You can post your thoughts on congokid.net or Spotify or Apple iTunes if you're listening from those platforms, or email me at jeff@congokid.net. Nonetheless, I trust there are many lingering lessons as you reflect back on this series. May God bless all who served in various capacities over the 100-plus years to fulfill God's call to missions in the Ubangi region of Congo. I also pray God's blessing on the work of the Congolese Church in the years ahead. And may there be a special appreciation and blessing for all those who lost loved ones or died doing God's work in Congo.
And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, "How beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news." Romans 10:15.
So that concludes this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and will listen again. Other podcasts and blog articles on a variety of topics can be found at congokid.net. In addition, Congo Kid's life stories are also posted on Apple iTunes, Google Podcast, and Spotify. I'm Jeff Eales, a.k.a. Congo Kid, your humble host. Until next time, I will send you off with a farewell in Lingala. Baninganangai, Tikalamalamu. My friends, stay well.